Close the borough sign, he's on the flat side. But I have to come up to Yeshiva to listen to him, which shows again why we have to have a connection to the Yeshiva. Rabbi Levin is also a professor of economics here at Yeshiva, and therefore he's going to speak to us about halacha business practices in today's market. Rabbi Levin.
We could.
Yeah,
just the interest rate's
going to go up or down.
Might as well find out.
That's how long
the water is. Yes, but not right away.
You gave an answer.
Both yes, but not right away.
Close the borough sign, he's on the flat side. But I have to come up to Yeshiva to listen to him, which shows again why we have to have a connection to the Yeshiva. Rabbi Levin is also a professor of economics here at Yeshiva, and therefore he's going to speak to us about halacha business practices in today's market. Rabbi Levin.
Thank you, Dr. Rosenstein, Rabbi Kupsik, thank you. Success in business is often predicated upon possession of superior information which one does not share with his opposite number. And we can imagine that there would be many transactions in the marketplace that would never take place if the opposite numbers would trade their information with each other. So therefore, I think that a very central point in business ethics involves the question of to what extent an individual has to share the information that he possesses. The story is told of Rav Elia Gushnitzer, who was the Mashkiach Rubani of the Lamzer Yeshiva in Pesach Tikva, and Hazon Ish, who was one of the Maskidim at his Leviathan, he said that this man was one of the Lamzer Sadiqim of his generation. And the story is told with the following. This Gavu, he had a paradise, an orchard, that he desperately wanted to sell. It was the main reason that he didn't want to leave this world as a balkol. So he was, he asked different yeshivas to say tilling to him that he was supposed to sell the orchard. Finally, one of the Talmidim, who was located in Yerushalayim, an American, came as a tourist and just expressed the desire that he wants to buy a paradise. So the Talmud contacted Rav Elia and told him that he had an opportunity. So they made up to meet in the office of the Talmud, and immediately Rav Elia told this American, he said, no, you want to buy the paradise. I'm very happy you want to buy it, but if you're going to be in America and your paradise is here, and the Gemara says above and see it up for test that if someone hires workers and doesn't supervise them, many of them also cannot speak. It's like you put money on the horns of a deer. The money will just run away from you. You won't see it anymore. He says, I don't know if you should buy this at all. He says, don't worry about it. I want to buy it. So then he tells him, well, I have to point to the halacha that you have to reveal every defect that is hidden in what you're selling, and I want you to know that there are some trees in the northern corner of the paradise that are not productive, and there's another area that has trees that are stunting the growth of the orchard, and you should know about these defects. Then he travels to the orchard, and Rav Elia is going to show him what the orchard looks like in the flesh, and he tells him, the Mechilta says that that I told you before about all the chasronos, but there you have to see it. I have to take you around and show you exactly what's happening here. All right, so the American is not fazed by all this. He seems still to be interested. And all of a sudden, the American takes out a bottle of pills and starts ingesting some pills. So Elliot gets very shaken up. What's the matter? Why are you taking these pills? So the American says, well, I have a slight heart condition. My doctor said that I have to take these pills once in a while. He says, I'm not going to let you borrow this much. You can't take the strain or the aggravation. This is not for a person of your health. And refuse to allow him to buy the orchard. This is, I think, this is the behavior of the Lama Bob. I think it indicates that Rosh Hashiva is not a good businessman. Also, you know, the Hadith's Hazaka Satora in the financial area as well. But the crucial question is, when the Torah requires us to disclose matters to an opposite number in transaction, what is the purpose of this disclosure? Are we supposed to disclose matters to protect the reasonable person in the marketplace? Or are we supposed to go even beyond that and protect even the ignorant, even people who should not really rely upon the presentations of the person that is trying to make the sale and has no business relying upon them because they're totally preposterous? And to give it an idea of what I really mean concretely by this question, this hakira, that the Federal Trade Commission in the United States, in its early years of operation, beginning in 1990, that they always felt that their duty was to protect even the ignorant consumer. So, for example, an automobile manufacturer made a claim that its automobile batteries last forever. So the FTC felt that a cease order can't make such a claim. It's a preposterous claim. But really, who would take this literally, especially considering the fact that the automobile manufacturer at the same time made the same year informed the public that for 50 cents a month you would be entitled to a service and a matter that in case the battery would fail, you would be entitled to replace it. So how is anyone going to take the first part of the year to mean literally that it'll last forever? Nevertheless, the FTC threw it down and said, you cannot continue such an advertisement. It is misleading. But misleading to who? To the ignorant man. We want to even protect the ignorant man. Another example was Claro in the early 1940s. They were claiming hair dye. They said, Claro permanently dyes hair. They said, what do you mean permanently? It also threw that down because this would imply that even new hair that emerges from the head will also be dyed in the Claro color. Now, who's going to make that assumption? It's only the ignorant, the preposterous type of assumption. They said, no, nothing doing. We have to protect even the ignorant men. But there was a change of heart in the late 1940s. They abandoned this doctrine of protecting the ignorant man, and they're only, this is Abayom HaZeh, they're only protecting the reasonable man. And the question is, in Halakha, what do we protect? Do we go back to the old doctrine of the early years of the FTC and we want to even protect the ignorant man? Or do we want even to protect the reasonable man? And Ramosha finds ourselves in Shulis, the Yoredea, not the Boshim, but the Yoredea, deals really with this issue. And it seemed that about 50 years ago, it was practice among butchers to soak liver in blood, to give it a healthy appearance, a fresh appearance. The question is this famous dust? Does this constitute misrepresentation of the merchandise, creating a false impression that it is fresh when in fact it is not? There were Gedolim at the time, Rabbi Shua Baumel and others writing the Haparadis that objected very much to this practice and said that the butcher must disclose to the customers that he's doing this, or else he's creating a false impression that the liver is fresh when in fact it's not. Rabbi Moshe himself said it's not necessary to make this disclosure. Why? It's based on Orach HaShulcha. The Kiva Shah Kol Yod, and everyone knows that this is a common practice. And when we go back to the question whether when it originated, whether it was honest or not honest, we're not going into that. But the fact is that at this point in time, everyone knows that it is a common practice among butchers to do this. And therefore, the onus of inquiry lies with the customer to ask whether this is fresh or not, or whether this just has the appearance of being fresh. Ramosha himself took very plainly the view that we are only going to be protecting the reasonable person, because we are expecting the participant in the marketplace to have at least reasonable knowledge of what practices are in the marketplace. We don't expect that they have perfect knowledge, but we don't allow them total naivete. He has to have at least a semblance of knowledge of what's going on, what common practice is. So the onus is on the consumer. He's supposed to realize that this is a common practice, and he's supposed to make inquiries. And if he doesn't make inquiries, he is at his own risk, he will lose out. But let us adopt this standard, the reasonable man standard, and let's relate this to a recent sensational incident that made the front page of the New York Times. There's an entrepreneur that runs a black kosher cruise known as the Black Yacht. A very frequent incident along this boat is they have their tours, brunch and dinner, Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday, etc. And they have these vessels are rented from world tours, cruise tours, and a frequent incident that occurs is that the pianist plays a waltz music, and all of a sudden a couple will make their way to the dance floor, but then from nowhere a rabbi will pop out and will tap the male partner on the shoulder and tell him that you can't dance here, you can't do this, mixed dancing, you're not allowed to do this here. If the male partner, if the partner, the people will not insist, if they will ignore him, then the mashgiach, the rabbi, will go to the pianist and he will tell the pianist, stop the music. And there will be, of course, a very awkward moment, a moment of embarrassment, and the pianist will not resume the music until the couple will go away from the dance floor. And the rabbi will get his way, of course, because of this, the frequency of these incidents. And I won't mention who the mashgiach, who the kashrim, the supervisor of the agency is. It makes no difference. We're just looking at this in the abstract, in any case. And they, because of the frequency of these incidents, the kashrim supervisor of the agency made it a clause in the contract. They renegotiated the contract with this entrepreneur, the black yacht entrepreneur, and he said that this is a precondition that if you don't abide by this clause of prohibiting mixed dancing on the dance floor, we will cancel our contract with you. So we have a really very important question of disclosure here, I think, business ethics. And what is the reasonable expectation in regard to a typical person that goes aboard this cruise liner? What is he to expect? Is he to expect that the only thing that's going to be supervised is the food? Black kosher food, as some people have quoted in the article, some of the patrons of the cruise liner said, or the reasonable expectation is, after all, if it's black kosher food, then everything has to be kosher. The morals of the people also have to be supervised, and there is a reasonable expectation to expect this to happen as well, that mixed dancing will be interfered with. What is a reasonable expectation? Now, I would submit that if it's unreasonable to expect interference on the part of the supervising agency in respect to the mixed dancing, then we have a very serious question of backup toss on the part of the patrons of this line. And I would suggest there are two things that are relevant here in making this determination. One is a reasonable expectation. One, let's go back 50 years to another tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein Zatzal with respect to the following question. Is it permissible for a caterer to take an affair when he knows as a certainty in advance that there will be mixed dancing at the affair? Rav Moshe Zatzal ruled that it is permissible to do so. And the reason he gave was, and I think this is built on the famous Rabbi Kiva Eger, the Shulchan Aruch, the Yardea, and the Pei Alta, we all know that the idea of minimizing the mikshel. The question is, here we have a facilitator, that the caterer was going to supervise the affair, appears to be facilitating the avera of mixed dancing by taking on the affair. But Rabbi Kiva Eger himself said that there is an idea of minimizing the mikshel. And I think Rav Moshe Zatzal is going in the same way, because it says that he can't take the affair, because if he does not do so, then the consequence will be that the people who want to party will take a caterer who is less scrupulous in respect to kashrus, and there will be more mechshon that will come out of this affair. Not only will the people have mixed dancing, which we assume will go on in any case, but they will in addition have the less reliable food. There might be mechshon and machalos asuros. So for this reason, Rav Moshe Zatzal ruled that it is permissible to do that.
Now, even according to the first of Moshe's Tshuva, Everybody knows there's no expectation.
Wait. Not so much. I'll get that.
Everything goes.
That's a good question. On the basis of the second shuva here, I would say that this is one relevant factor, that a typical person wants to make use of this cruise, that he has a reasonable expectation that the people that undertook to supervise the kashrus, that was the extent of their job. Since it is allowedly permissible to take on a job when there would be mixed dancing, that already does generate a reasonable expectation that there would be no interference with the mixed dancing. Now, getting to what Dr. Rosenstein was saying about whether we can say that anyone who goes aboard may presume that the only thing that knows about, independent of this question of halakha, of when to take on such a job, is it reasonable to presume that the only thing, what do we mean by black culture, really? When someone sees black culture, what does he take that to mean? When there's an affair that's black culture, does he take that to mean only food and nothing else? Or do you take that to mean a broader concept of it? And he understands that there will be nothing that will offend his religious sensitivities there, and the obvious thing being there, there won't be any mixed dancing. Now, I would say that if this Latya was very meticulous to only advertise the Jewish Observer and some other such organs, and would not in any way solicit from the general public knowledge of their existence, and try to, they would make no point to advertise their existence to anyone else except groups that clearly would be terribly affected by such a thing. There might be a room to say that they are not obligated to make this disclosure, that they will object to the mixed dancing. But I don't think this is the case whatsoever, because the article quoted that people go on this cruise, Mount Vernon, conservative temples, Mount Vernon, they bring a whole party, the mother had a birthday party, they bring 15 people along. So it's 200 passengers, and it's open to the public, and I don't even know the advertisers look together. So what is the relevant
reason? The New York Times.
The New York Times.
Oh, re advertising because of the big article.
Oh, right. So the question is, which group are they making an explicit presentation to, representation to? Now, it would seem that unless they're making a conscious effort to only get the attention of a very narrow group of people that will take the connotation of black culture to mean a whole collateral ideas as well, not just the food, it means the whole ambiance of the place, they might have an argument that that this is a reasonable explanation. I don't think they made such an attempt in any sense of the word. The cruise liner is there on port and says black culture. It does. So what I'm talking about is this. I would think that business ethics would tell them you can't have it both ways. You don't want to have mixed dancing on the floor. You should advertise in advance, and certainly before you accept tickets from people, money from people, tell them this is what you should expect. At the very least, it's a gray area. I think it's worse than a gray area. They should say that the food is black culture and there will be no mixed dancing. Then they're home safe. But they have it both ways. Just to conveniently leave that out and just to say black culture, and we have all kinds of people that come aboard this vessel, and then later, once they're a captured audience, captive audience, then to make this revelation to them, there is a very serious question of Chilul Hashem as well. Because here we have the Ben Adam Haver, Ben Adam Markham are very much going to be the associate. And I think it's very, very relevant also what Rosh Hashanah Zalman Arbach leads to Mincha Shlomo says. Very interesting tshuva, Simon Lamed Hay, in his tshuvas, he deals with the following question. Is it permissible for a restaurant to serve non-observant Jews? Well, we know for sure they don't wash, they don't wear any kippahs, they don't bench. Is it permissible? Let's say either we are facilitating averos by serving these people. He says, no question about it, that it is a mifshal to do this. This is Rabbi Akiva Eger's style of minimizing the mifshal. He says, yes, it is a mifshal, yes, but not serving these people will certainly engender hatred toward religious Jews. That's a bigger mifshal.
The idea is to minimize the milkshow. And here we have people from conservative backgrounds who are even making lawsuits in secular courts against the against the owners of the lot yacht. So there's a question of engendering hatred towards religious Jews by making this intervention. And when we talk about coercive intervention and enforcing halakha, I think we have to be very careful that we people should perceive that there is perfect integrity and sincerity in this attempt. People just see it, Chassid Shalom, as a means of maximizing profit. That is, you make use of this ploy. You choose not to disclose what you will be doing to board the line that you will not allow the mixed dancing for the purpose of just enticing the largest possible patrons, so you fill out the boat, you have 200 people, and then once they're a captive audience, you make this announcement. This really is raises questions of Chilul Hashem as well. In terms of, yes?
Since you're talking about the term glut, I would like to ask you a question since you're into this thing. The term glut means perfect or pure, and
smooth.
Smooth. Okay. Which connotative it comes to me that the shulchan that they slaughtered the behemoth, that after the pnikas pnim, he finds no shulchan at all.
Right.
And then it's a perfect thing.
That's glut.
But now it's a physical possibility that the whole world, so to speak, now eats glut. That all the shulchan, the shulchan gudra, the pnikas pnim, and
One of these places are buying from one main source of meat, and that is Ali Packing. 99% of all catering all over the place is buying from Ali Packing.
It means what?
All of Ali Packing is supposedly without sirkus.
Well, that means all along that had bumps and had shilas were shipped off to the glacier.
Correct. Correct.
But still on the market.
Correct.
So the term is still kosher.
I think as a writer, there's an ancillary problem there in that glut is that you defined it more or less. But what about, a Milton restaurant I saw?
Right.
Which is a condition place. This is glut.
And think of it, if you have to have shita for fish also.
There's a misrepresentation.
Getting back to the squad, though.
Yes.
On this glut yacht, most yachts have dancing.
Yeah.
And most groom people don't go to yachts these days too much.
Well,
so what about a hotel?
That's very good. That's
and I said, same thing in a hotel.
Yes.
That, you know, I'm only the mashgiach on the food, and if these people want to play cards on Shabbos or put on my Shabbos, not my business, and I can't afford
it. Israel, they have a very interesting ruling that the Rabbanus of Russia's Eretz Yisrael, they want to make a provision that they can't have belly dancing in any of the restaurants that give out coffee. But the Supreme Court knocked it down, and they said that you only can be able to supervise the food. That's it. You can make a halakha case also that the people that are interested in these things, you will not be able to just suppress it. They will go elsewhere to get their entertainment. And the idea of minimizing the mashalim in such a place, Ben Torah is not going to go into a restaurant with belly dancing. Will not go there. That's the order. So the type of crowd goes there. You have marginal people that if you don't allow them this entertainment, they'll point it elsewhere. It's not kosher. It's the same idea. You're minimizing the mashalim. I think it's a matter of public policy. Let's go on to something else. Another great area of disclosure. I think it's a very exciting thing. It's historical, but let's go back to the year 1850. June 19, 1850. The Battle of Waterloo was lost by Napoleon to Lord Wellington. And the news of Wellington's victory reached Nathan Rothschild, a in London many hours before it reached that city. And here's Rothschild made it, and the Rothschild family made a considerable expenditure investment in what happened called a private news network. Quite an expenditure of finding out news as soon as that. In fact, that's what they based their success, their phenomenal success, on this period of information they were able to obtain through this private network. Now, David Rothschild had the news that England, Great Britain, won the war. And for days, the London Stock Exchange was straining its ears, all the traders were told, if Great Britain wins, then British consols, that is, British bonds, they will soar in value because they won the war. And on the other hand, if Napoleon wins the battle, the British consols will just sink, plummet in value. So Nathan Rothschild, he has the insider information. He has the superior information that Wellington won battle. Now, his reputation was really as such that whatever he could do as a trade would bull or bear issue. All of those terms, bull and bear, make something go up, something go down, and basically, of course, people just copy his trade. Whatever he does. Rothschild knows, people said, whatever he does, everyone copies his trade. What do you think he would do in this situation? Anyone else in his position would sink his whole worth into consols, into British consols, right? He didn't do that. He sold the consols. And when people saw that he sold the consols, they said, Rothschild knows everything is lost, that Great Britain lost the battle, and that everyone else, his sale of the consols triggered panic selling of consols, British consols. It plummeted into almost nothing, and when it went, and the expression that historians use is, once they went to the club with so much in value that he bought a whole bundle of them for a song, British consuls. Then, a couple of minutes later, the news arrived, the British won, and the consuls soared in value, and he sold them and made a fortune. One of the fortunes of the Rothschilds made that way. So let's deal with the ethics of that situation. It's either very shrewd or it amounts to canardry, what he did. So the question, really, disclosure, he has this information that the British won. Does he have to share it with anyone? He certainly doesn't have to share it because this information he obtained through his own investment in his private news network investment. Does he have a property right? Does he have a kingdom mama in this information? No, certainly doesn't, because this information is in the public domain. You can't say that he has a kingdom in this information. It's public information, right? But the question is, does he have a right to protect his information from free riding? The horror, once he makes his trade and he buys the British consul, it's ready. He said, "Man, what does he care that everyone else will copy his trade?" Once he has made his trade, it should be a question of Midas Stonehaven not to allow people to copy his trade. Zendanim is a law puzzle. However, the Mordechai, this is a famous Mordechai quote in the Shulchan, says that even though we have a cloud, that someone would occupy, a squatter would occupy someone's apartment that was low on the name, that it was not an apartment that the landlord would usually want to rent out. And he's discovered this squatter has been there for a month, 2 months. And so does the landlord have any right to collect rent for the interim for the time that the squatter was occupying the apartment? No. Zenana is a law pasa. It is an apartment, the law of the maker. It is a type of apartment that the landlord does not plan to rent out. And this person is like a nana, he's nana, but Zenana is a law pasa apartment. There's no claim, there's no dini mamonos here at all. However,
Wait.
Mordechai quoted in the Shulchan Aruch, the law post of Mordechai, and this is brought down in all the other poskim. In any case, the landlord does have the right to object in the future for this squad to be there. Even though he doesn't plan, this is what Mordechai says, even though he does not plan to rent out the apartment, and what would you say, if you don't plan to rent it out, what nerve do you have not to let me stay there? Send in the law post. No, Mordechai says that since theoretically he could rent it out, he has the right to object to this person as far as to be there. And this really tells us the same thing in Baba Kama, about Bezon Bez, same idea. What's the svar behind it? because this is really an invasion in the bylaws of landlord. Essential aspect of bylaws is that I have right to object someone making use of my property. If you could just come to me and force me to make use of my property, then that detracts from my bylaws. If I don't know about it altogether, and you live in the apartment, and I wanted to question this, collecting rent, I can't collect rent, because we have to follow ZNN and law process process. But to object, look, I feel like if I theoretically could make money from it, even though at this point I don't want to rent it out, because it is a commodity of value that I could get money for, a price for, in the marketplace, I do have the right to object it. This is a principle that is muskum in Schopenhauer. So here we have the same thing. Rothschild ready, made his trade. So, you know, he certainly could sell this information for a nice, hefty price. Anybody would equally pay a nice price to have this inside information. Even if he chooses not to sell it, we have to invoke the Mordecai. What the Mordecai says that he have a right to object to someone simply free riding on the information that he has.
Yeah, but he didn't, but, of course, that he sold short first.
Let me go step by step. Let's go here step by step. Now, the next point that I want to bring out is that the MS, you can't even say that he's low bossa if someone copies his trade. That whole assumption is wrong. The idea someone, he already made his investment, he protected it, that no one got rid of it until he made the trade. But to say that if other people are going to copy the trade, this in no way can hurt Rothschild, he's low bossa, that's an incorrect assumption. Why? Because what is critical and making money on investment is not when you buy, but when you sell. It's the timing that is more critical. Now, if Rothschild can keep this information secret until the actual news reaches the London Exchange, this would really help very much in the timing of the sell. Because as we know, that if an event is not anticipated by the marketplace, and when something happens, it's a surprise event, then the marketplace will react to it and will reflect the new assessment of what British consuls are worth in light of the fact that Great Britain won the war. And if we can prevent the market from discounting this information before the actual event occurs, then the actual news arriving at the London Exchange will constitute a surprise event, and this will be critical in allowing Rothschild to gauge when he will sell. There will be a jump in the price, and maybe we'll say, I kind of think this is a good time to sell when the marketplace reacts to the news, because if you want it low and be greedy and keep on waiting some more, there could be a whole bunch of people that will buy on the good on this news, and then a whole number of people that will be suddenly selling, and the price suddenly goes down and he loses out. So this is certainly an edge to have a surprise event, and if people copy the information, it's no longer going to be a surprise event. Everyone knows about it. And what's going to happen? He can make a bad mistake, and he can sell after a lot of other people decide to sell. So he certainly could sustain a big loss if other people copy his trade. In short, allowing other people to copy his trade will deprive him of any edge he might otherwise have out of the surprise event when the actual news reaches the exchange. Yeah,
that's just described. It's legitimate to nothing. We should not too. And okay. Not to act, because if he acts on the information, those people will pick up on it. But it does not clarify right, whether he's allowed to accept it.
So let me proceed to the next step. Now, we've seen that what Rothschild has the right to do is to protect his information from free riding. He definitely has that right. He made an investment in his information, and he will be a hustler, someone who copies his trade. He has a right to protect his information. Now, the only time that we could say that there is an obligation to disclose information is simply if the opposite number has a right to that information. If he has a right to that information, you must disclose it, and not only disclose it, but in a forthright manner. When the opposite number has no right to the information, you have no obligation to disclose it, and you can engage in what we would call diversionary tactics to throw off your opposite number from ever off balance, ever thinking that there would be questions to ask, that this information might be there in the marketplace. So since Rothschild does have the right to protect his information, he does not have to share it, he would be quite legitimate then to engage in diversionary tactics. Now, since he can engage in diversionary tactics, it would be quite legitimate on his part to do exactly what he did, to sell the consoles. That's a diversion. Now, if people want to copy his trade and fall into the trap, then Ewoks are an option. People are just losing by their own, at their own risk. If they want to copy his trade and it will trigger a panic sell, panic selling, then that's their own fault. They're at their own risk, because the point is that he's not obligated to share the information. If he doesn't have to share the information, he's allowed to protect it. And if anyone wants to interpret what he does, they're at their own risk. And therefore, there are two scenarios that are possible for Rothschild. If people just ignore what he did, which certainly must have been the case oftentimes, that if he does something, people it does not trigger panic selling in this case, then he would be able to shorten the time span between the information that he received and the actual disclosure of the information to the market at large, and therefore he would be able to get a good shot at having a surprise event of the actual information. In the event that people took it upon themselves to copy his trade, and would trigger the panic selling, he would get another bonanza, which he actually did. It was both daring, a very daring move, and a costly move on his part to sell. And if people would foolishly copy what he does, then he would even get a bigger bonanza. To say that he was delivering a false signal to the market is really only valid under the assumption that he was obligated to share what he has with the market. He's not obligated to do so, and I would say he definitely has all the right in the world to protect his information. And I just want to mention, I don't want to go into the technicalities of this, but in the modern marketplace, when there is very common the phenomenon of arbitrage, when a trader will simultaneously engage in two equivalent trades of opposite effect, buying and selling at the same time, hedging, and I wouldn't go into these details later if someone's interested, that certainly you cannot take any particular trade of someone as a signal of what his opinion of the direction of the market is, because he could very well be engaged in arbitrage and at the same time be something else. He could be buying long-term government securities and at the same time selling short-term government securities. This is an arbitrage, is called speculating on the spread of the yield curve. That's what it's called technically. And there are many other types of arbitrage, that are hedges that people do that are much simpler than that one. I don't know why I thought of that one, but so you can't really infer any opinion of the trader on a particular deal that he's doing. Now, I'd like to move to something else. This next point, I picked up one of the economic textbooks that I happen to be looking at. And economists, he was trying to show that economic principles are used in everyday life. So he started off with a little joke that we should call the economic joke number three. And that I liked so much the joke that I was looking through the whole textbook. First I looked at the index to see if I could find an index of economic jokes. And there's nothing here. So I had to go through the whole book to find the other jokes, which I didn't care for. But this was, I found was to die. The whole book begins itself, this joke. Businessman and economist, they found themselves stranded in the forest, and all of a sudden, a ferocious bear was upon them. The economist made a move to run away, and the businessman said to him, "You silly economist, with your silly assumptions, you think you can outrun the bear?" The economist snapped back and said, "Wrong! I only assume I can outrun you."
You!
Now, the generalization of this principle was that in any conflict situation, the objective should always be not to totally decimate and defeat an enemy, or prevent that enemy from defeating you. It's not necessary to do that. It's only necessary to defeat an enemy to make it very costly and against his own interests to pursue his desired course of action. Now, how does he illustrate this idea, this principle? You don't have to overwhelm, decimate an enemy. Just make it not in his interest to pursue what his desired course of action. He gives the example of this person who wrote a book. He was known as a super thief. That he was a very class act burglar, and he was known to. He would go into a home, burglarize a home, and he would find that booty was not to his liking. He would just pile it up on the kitchen table, and on his way out, he would take the control panel of the burglar alarm just to let people know he was there, that it wasn't to die and steal this thing.
And other times when he would go in, he would always reset the alarm, which would leave, that to prevent less discriminating burglars from entering. But finally, his career came to an abrupt end when the state of Florida sent him on an unplanned vacation to the state penitentiary. And when he arrived there, he decided to be, in a matter of speaking, about tshuva, and he wanted to write a book of advising homeowners how can they thwart would-be burglars using this principle that you don't have to totally defeat the burglar, make it impossible for him to knock down your windows or doors. You go to that expense. The smart strategy is simply to play mind games with the burglar. And gave you different examples. Example of, you should put in your backyard gigantic rubber bones. The burglar will get an impression that it's a ferocious dog that's going to roam around the backyard. Stay away, you'll see these big, gigantic rubber bones. Put a little note on the front window of your home and saying that this home is along with laser alarm system, both active and passive devices available. Occupant bears no responsibility to any injuries that intruder will bear. That will be with the burglar when he sees, this is an imaginary burglar, who has a laser alarm system? Now, it's not only imaginary that the homeowner doesn't have such a device, no one has it. And if you get a real professional burglar, he will know how to get into a lot of different devices, but this one he never heard of. So, Lo Shom Niketeno, Baruch Nisuro, and then bite them, and go to somebody else's house. And another idea, why not plaster on the window a fictitious note to a fictitious name? Tell him about Mrs. Jones. The exterminators were here. We have not yet aired out the house. Stay away from the back rooms. Vague expression, what are back rooms? They could be anything, most of the house. And the burglar will get an idea that he comes into the house and will be ingesting a big dosage of poisonous gas. And he might even put a P.S. Saddam is in the bedroom. Who is Saddam? He's a rotten Cowboy Pinball or a German Shepherd, a Doberman. So, parties, tremendous, cost very little money. Forget about the alarm systems. You don't need any more alarm systems. What do you need them for? Play these mind games with burglars. Question is this. Here we have the ultimate of what might be considered a mirror law. We have Armand and mirror law, the same letters, just arranged differently. And you know, mirror law is permissible shrewdness. Yitzchok says, the Yaakov Bochir, the mirror law, the Yitzchok Bochir, the Targum says, it means what? With shrewdness, but arma, is gnarly, is the work of the Yetzer Hara himself. So, this might very well represent the limits of mirror law. Apparently, it represents a creation of a false impression to the would-be burglar that you have all these devices. Is there anything wrong with doing this? I would submit, certainly not, because we know the halacha. That if someone breaks in Rachmanis in somebody's house, what halacha does he have? Abov Machteris, he's a rodent. And Mitin Latzilu Benafsho, we are permitted, even if necessary, to eliminate him. And we have, though, a very important principle. Yomo Lahatsil Me'echad Me'evar, if you can stop the rodent with minimal force, you are obligated to do so. If you can stop it without killing it, doing something much, an injury or something much less than that, preservation of human life, even on the part of the rodent, is central. So here we have these ideas of putting these notes on the window, on the door, of which are total lies. It's not a false suggestion. They are just total lies. But who are they directed at? At the potential thief at the time of his decision, when he has that moment of truth, when he has to make a decision, whether he wants to break in into that house, he will be reading that, and that might deter him. Yahweh left to the left of Lord. Instead, you are permitted even to kill him, so to prevent him from coming in and having the halot shame of the roday, I would think that Levada, you're allowed to untake these devices. Yes, I think that's about it. We might have questions.
In the case of Rush, I'm not sure if it's a direct example, but the Gemara said that, for example, people saw Reish Lakish do sign on a star, do certain things that would give them
inordinate amount of trust based on that kind of behavior.
Right.
Because they knew the kind of person Ray Schlager was.
Right.
If Mr. Rothschild had a reputation as being a very honest or straight person, it appears that this might have...
Well, see, we're dealing here with that. If Mr. Rothschild is dealing with a face-to-face transaction, he's selling something to someone, and there was something that he was obligated to disclose, some defect, that's what we're talking about. Any defect that's hidden, he must disclose. Then there's certainly an obligation to disclose it. But here we're dealing in a really impersonal market when it's really, again, when we started the whole discussion, that there is quite a lot of information in the marketplace that is not shared, and there's no obligation to share this information.
I got a telegram that would be
checked as well.
The Sahatol is a business you shouldn't expect to be dealing with a lot of public.
We had two wonderful speakers, and I think the message that I welcome from everybody is that we should continue. All right. Intensive.